Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Macramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. On this week's episode, we'll discuss the Goldschmidt trade, the signings of Eovaldi and Corbin, our predictions for the winter meetings, and another batch of our favorite holiday-themed player names. Then, as usual, we'll wrap up with another This Week in Baseball History. Before we get to this week's discussion topics, we must take a moment to note the passing of Luis Valbuena and Jose Castillo. We are saddened by the senseless loss, and our condolences go out to their families. The blockbuster trades continued this week, with the Cardinals acquiring Paul Goldschmidt from Arizona in exchange for Carson Kelly, Luke Weaver, and minor leaguer Andrew Young, as well as a compensatory... I cannot pronounce.
Compensatory.
There we go. Pick in 2019. So what do we think of the return for Goldschmidt?
It seems a little light. Obviously, Goldschmidt has only 1 year left on his contract, but it doesn't seem like any of the three players are really that much of a surefire thing. So even with the 1 year remaining, it just seems like Arizona might have been able to, or at least theoretically should have been able to, get more for him.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the best, if not the best, first baseman in the game right now. One of the best hitters in the game. It is a move that immediately makes the Cardinals so much better and doesn't necessarily do the same for the D-backs. I think the D-backs are not necessarily thinking that next year is going to be a super competitive year for them. I think, you know, they understand that the Dodgers are still the Dodgers and the Rockies are now forced to be contended with as well. And this is a more forward-thinking move. And, you know, we could see if there are other moves that they make as well that reflect that. There's been a lot of Greinke trade rumors. If Goldschmidt can be on the move, then that kind of suggests that they're thinking that next year is not going to be their season.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think they're planning more long term. I think that if they're trying to basically do a rebuild, it makes total sense that they would trade Goldschmidt. But I think they just got fleeced in this deal. I think that they could have gotten so much more for Goldschmidt. And the Cardinals are getting away with, like, they're getting away with basically trading as little as they can for a superstar like Paul Goldschmidt. And I think that the D-backs are now going to have to, like, look pretty hard internally if they're going to look for a first base option, because the options are not pretty. And it just makes it even more clear that, yeah, they're not planning on contending next year, because they know what their odds are, and the fact that they kind of dwindled down in the middle of the past season from top of the NL West to third and not making the postseason. I think they know realistically what they need to do. It's just, this is not the most ideal return for Goldschmidt. So what other moves do the Cardinals need to make in order to overtake the Cubs and the Brewers?
Well, I think they need to try and shore up their pitching staff, both starters and bullpen. They seem pretty set with their top two starters, but Luke Weaver was slotted in as their third starter for the season. He obviously was not that great in the 136 innings he pitched for them, but nonetheless, they'll have to find a replacement for that, and it ideally would be quite a bit of an upgrade. So that should be one of their primary concerns going forward.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I would note that particularly they need Michael Wacha next season to, you know, be kind of what they know he can be and hope he can be, because that's something that kind of after that rookie season, they haven't gotten from him quite so much. They have an issue with the outfield. You know, they haven't been getting what they wanted to get from Dexter Fowler, and I don't know if that's going to change. There's something to be said for giving Dexter Fowler a trade that it seems like he has wanted for a while now, and, you know, trying to figure out another option from there, because I'm not sure that Fowler is the solution they need. Yeah, it's there's still a long way for them to go, I think, before they're going to be truly competitive with the Cubs and the Brewers.
Yeah, it just seems like they need a little bit of an upgrade everywhere still. And obviously, it seems like they have a lot of organizational issues to work out as well, particularly with everything that happened with, as you were saying, Dexter Fowler. So it seems like there's still quite a bit of work to do for them.
Yeah, I think getting Goldschmidt is definitely a huge upgrade in the offense and on defense as well. It's just they still have a long way to go if they're going to try to beat both the Cubs and the Brewers. I don't think that this is going to be the end of the moves that they make, but I think they're also going to have to look realistically as to, like, what is possible and what they can possibly get, especially since the starting pitching free agent market is not necessarily the most filled with, well, starting pitchers. But, I mean, trades are always an option. Who knows, they could get Noah Syndergaard, which, oh my god, that would mean that Cardinals level magic is real. But I think it's still going to take a lot for them to be in contention to win the NL Central. Wild card, maybe, but it would have to be like the second wild card spot.
Yeah, and like there you have the Rockies and you have any assortment of NL East teams. So this is not going to be an easy battle for the Cards.
Yeah, there's just way too many good teams in the National League that it's just a total crapshoot every year.
Well, moving over to the American League, the Nathan Eovaldi sweepstakes are officially over as he is returning to the Red Sox on a 4-year, $68 million contract. Is it in any way surprising he decided to sign with Boston?
No, I don't think so. It seemed like right from the beginning of the offseason, the Red Sox were very interested in having him return to the team. Obviously, all of the players there love Eovaldi, not just for his postseason heroics, but it just seems like he has the personality that fits right in with the team. And then the Red Sox are one of the few teams who have displayed the fact that money isn't really a concern for them. So it seemed like it was a priority for the Red Sox to have this signing, and Eovaldi obviously really enjoyed his time with the Red Sox in the second half of the season. So it's a move that for both parties makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is not really that much of a surprise. I think that it makes the most sense for both teams, especially with the Red Sox just having won the World Series and everything. I think it's not only something that benefits both players, but it makes the most sense in the long run. And that 4-year, $68 million contract looks pretty good, and hopefully it will look pretty good still in 4 years.
Eovaldi is a guy who has not quite ever lived up to the potential that he has, but we certainly saw the best of him in Boston this year, and I think that it's a good move for them in that regard, assuming that he can keep it up. Are there any other roster additions that the Red Sox need to make in order to give them the best shot at repeating as champions?
Well, I think they need to do several things with the bullpen, particularly since they can't rely on their starting pitchers to fill those bullpen holes in the regular season, and particularly with Craig Kimball hitting free agency. So they need to do something with the closer position. I don't know if they'll sign or trade for somebody or rely on somebody like Joe Kelly to have that role, But there are definitely several upgrades that need to be made so that they are not in a position like they were this past postseason with a bullpen where no pitcher was that trusted.
Yeah, I think pitching is definitely one of the things they're going to have to look at the most this offseason, whether it be strengthening their starting rotation or adding to the bullpen. I think they're just going to have to look at what's available on the market and what they can get through trade. And who knows, maybe they will get Noah Syndergaard.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
I don't know that like they have the depth necessary to make that trade, but like you never know.
The Mets.
It's the Mets, exactly. I mean, it's they got a new GM at the helm, but still the Mets. That's my analysis of this trade scenario.
Well, switching back to the NL, also signing this week was perhaps the best free agent pitcher on the market, Patrick Corbin, who agreed to a 6-year, $140 million contract with the Nationals. Just what is Washington getting in Corbin? And is this a sign that the team will be competitive?
I think it is a sign that they're going to be competitive. This is a huge upgrade to the rotation. It was that was something of an issue for them last year when you got beyond the big two frontline guys. But now they have like a really strong top three, and that can totally transform a team. It definitely shows they're going for it too. Rizzo said like last week or 2 weeks ago that, you know, Harper isn't holding up their plans. They're focusing more on filling the needs that they have right now, and that was one of them. They may still need to get another starting pitcher, still need to make some moves in the bullpen, but I think it's very much a sign that they're going to be going for it. And as for what they're getting in Corbin, they're getting a guy who I think is finally kind of back to what he had the ability to be. You know, he had Tommy John back in 2014, and it can take a while to get back to form after that. He was good in 2015, down year in 2016, good again the next year, and this past season was like legitimately great. So thinking that he's back to what they hope he can be, and I think that they are making a statement by swooping him up.
Yeah, I think with this move, the Nationals are still going to try to go for it. It seemed like they were just kind of like, well, let's wait and see if they're going to actually compete in 2019. And they're making it clear that they don't want their window to close just yet, and they're trying to make that possible. I think they still have a long ways to go to make that actually happen and make the NL East a very exciting race. But, you know, in Corbin, they're getting someone who will make that a pretty scary rotation. You know, Sarah, like you said, you know, they already have the two big frontline starters, and having Corbin and making it three really, really good pitchers and three solid pitchers and reliable ones at that, it does a lot for their chances. And in baseball now with so many power hitters, having really good pitching is key, and I think the Nationals recognize that, and I think they're going to try to go something similar with the bullpen as well. I think they're trying to make a statement with this, and I think it's working.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And with the 6-year contract and having Scherzer locked up for several more years as well gives them an extended window to ensure that they can still compete with Atlanta and perhaps Philly and perhaps the Mets. So if they kind of continue on this path of really trying to go for it this season, it could be incredibly exciting in the NL East, and not just for the usual reasons of absolute terrible mayhem. So where do the signings of Eovaldi and Corbin leave the starting pitcher market?
Chaos. It's definitely going to be focused on trades a little bit more now. I think if teams are going to be looking for starting pitching that is a lot better than what is available in the free agent market, And that's why I kept bringing up Noah Syndergaard, because he might just be like one of the best pitchers available on the trade market right now. That is, if he continues to be on the trade market, we don't know, because Mets. But I think it's going to be a lot harder for teams to try and look for starting pitching. They're going to have to look internally, or they're going to have to see what they have available for trade. So I think that's how it's going to be for the rest of the offseason.
Yeah, I guess now kind of the big story is what happens with Yusei Kikuchi. Seems like he's probably going to be coming over to play for some team in MLB, but I, at this point, who knows who that's going to be. But that's going to be a thing that I think we'll all be keeping an eye on. As for the best free agent MLB pitchers, Dallas Keuchel, I guess, is the big name left out there right now. He's 31 years old, so not super young guy, but, you know, probably still can land a 3 or 4 year deal at this point. There's a handful of other guys who are available still, more than a handful. There's a number of other guys, but in terms of legitimately enticing names, I guess there's Bartolo Colon, but in terms of guys you actually think can actively make your rotation better at this point, that's a little bit more limited right now.
Yeah, it really seems like any of the massively impactful pitching moves that will happen would have to be through trades at this point. It doesn't seem like any team is going to grab a free agent starting pitcher that is going to have the opportunity to become like a Patrick Corbin or to have the impact of an Eovaldi. Maybe this will make it more likely that Syndergaard will get traded if teams out there get really desperate for a starting pitcher and get desperate enough to offer a package that the Mets would be foolish to turn down.
Yeah, and that's probably why there's going to be a lot of fake trade packages proposed to see if Syndergaard would be traded for that, because in all scenarios, I would assume that all the teams that are trying to compete would want to go for Syndergaard, but we'll see what they have available. The winter meetings have begun in Las Vegas by the time that you're listening to this episode, but that doesn't mean there isn't still time for plenty of speculation, especially with Theo Epstein stating that he expects the week to be, quote, really active. What moves do we think teams will make this week?
I don't know if I believe Theo on this. I feel like every season we expect the winter meetings to be really action-packed, and they're usually pretty uneventful, as it turns out. Like, I feel like it's more that we see kind of the seeds of things being sown. We start hearing rumors of trades that we might not have thought of otherwise, but that they kind of take a little while to actually come to fruition. So I don't know. I'm not expecting anything huge this week.
Yeah, it seems like all of the huge things that might potentially have come to fruition at the winter meetings have happened prior to them this season, and especially what happened last season with all of the players kind of being forced to sign in the last weeks of free agency. It doesn't fill me with confidence that there will be a lot of wheeling and dealing done this week, but there definitely will be a lot of rumors of wheeling and dealing, and who doesn't love that stuff?
I feel like if anything, moves that will be made will be through the Rule 5 draft, because that's something that has to happen during the winter meetings. So we'll see what happens there, I guess. I'm not expecting much of anything aside from teams getting some players through Rule 5, but that's kind of a given every year, so that's another way of saying I'm not expecting much.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that Harper Machado would sign this week. I think we'll likely have to wait a while for either one of those to sign with the team, and it seems like those are the two big moves remaining that would really set everything off for the rest of the teams.
Those are obviously the big things that we're waiting on at this point. For all the talk of this being a huge offseason for free agency. Hasn't really come to pass, but we do still have those two guys out there, and it is going to be huge and send waves throughout baseball when it happens. But I'm with Mary in that I don't think it'll be this week.
I just hope that Bryce Harper goes all LeBron James, the decision on it.
I mean, I guess, like, he is from Vegas, so that, like, if he were to do something big in that sense, maybe this would be the week for it. But, like, I could totally see him just announcing it on, like, Snapchat or something with a new sponsorship deal.
That would be incredibly Bryce.
It would also be really amusing and would make this offseason a little bit more interesting.
This offseason's been pretty interesting, but I agree that Bryce Harper could make it more interesting. And will eventually, but, like, could make it, like, really, really interesting.
Yeah, like, right now.
And here is Bryce Harper from the casino floor of Caesar's Palace on Snapchat announcing where he's going to sign.
That would be the most 2018 thing.
That really would.
It would become a may-may. I'm sorry, I have to go there.
Yeah, he deserves that. All right, well, we have a little may-may of our own. This December, we're sharing some of our favorite holiday-themed baseball player names with you. Last week, we delved into the Hanukkah-themed names, and this week, it's all about nature. We will start with the Winters. George Winter pitched for 8 seasons from 1901 to 1908, 7.5 with Boston and half a season with Detroit. Over these 8 seasons, he compiled an 83-102 record and a 2.87 ERA.
Yeah, I think he is one of the better Winters, because we move on to Jesse Winters, who's also a pitcher, who split time between the Giants and the Phillies in his 5-year career from 1919 to 1923. He compiled a 12-14 record and a dismal 5.04 ERA over 405 innings. At that point in baseball, it was really difficult to get an ERA that high, so congrats to Jesse Winters for that feat.
And then there's Clarence Winters, who pitched only 7 innings in MLB, all coming with Boston in the 1924 season. In those 7 innings, he gave up 16 earned runs. Not great, but notable.
Yeah, it was not one of the better seasons for Boston. They had very few better seasons from that period of time right on up to 2004.
Yeah, but I think you guys are doing okay right now.
No, we're very beleaguered. I want all your sympathy.
I'm not going to give that to you. Instead, I'll give it to right fielder Matt Winters, who also played in only one season, his coming in 1989 for the Royals. He recorded 25 hits in 107 at-bats for an OPS plus of 88. So I guess you could say that these were some rough winters, right?
Wow. I thought I was the designated bad pun maker here, but I also applaud it.
Sharing is caring, after all. Well, let's move on to the Hollies, beginning with the first and only to have a double Holly name. Center fielder and second baseman Holly Hollingshead played for Washington from 1872 to 1875, though he missed the 1874 season for inexplicable reasons. Across these 3 seasons, he played in only 58 games, recording a .247 average.
Ed Holly played shortstop for St. Louis, appearing in 160 games from 1906 to 07. He hit just .229 with a .562 OPS, would revive his career in 1914, to play in the newly formed but short-lasting Federal League, achieving a slightly better .664 OPS in 116 games.
Imagine thinking that, like, this was your chance to get back into baseball and it's with the Federal League. Poor guy.
Poor Ed. And then we have Jeff Holly, who pitched for Minnesota from 1977 to 1979, compiling a .560 ERA across 90 innings.
Amazing that he lasted 90 innings.
Good for him, I guess.
Yep. You know, you got to make a career somehow. And he certainly did that. That's 90 mornings than I've ever pitched in the majors.
True, same.
Well, we end with the final category of snow names. There's only one snow, but I think it's an important one. Felton Snow played 16 seasons in the Negro Leagues from 1931 to 1946, predominantly for Baltimore. He managed the Baltimore team in his final season, adeptly placing them in the thick of the pennant race, and was noted as one of the best managers in the Negro Leagues that season.
I guess we should also note Juan Nieves, who is basically the Spanish Jon Snow. I'm not a Game of Thrones person myself, but I know that's something people enjoy, and it's relevant here because snow.
I know that's something people enjoy.
I'm just sad that Ice Zach Fleming did not pan out for the Yankees, because that is certainly a name. Like, no, it's not going to be Isaac, like A-S-A-A-C. It's going to be Ice Zach, spelled exactly how it sounds.
Yeah, that's really a huge bummer that he did not pan out, because that's a name that I think a lot of people could have a lot of fun with.
As goes baseball draft. And now for this week in baseball history. On December 9th, 1931, due to financial concerns brought on by the Great Depression, baseball's owners decided to cut squads from 25 players to 23. The number would shift back to 25 in 1939.
What two positions do you think that people would cut today to get the roster from 25 to 23?
It's got to be pitchers, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe like a second string catcher, maybe?
I feel like they would just go all a full on bullpenning. So, pitchers.
Yeah, well, wonder how that worked out for them. In a few years after that, in this period, during which we would have had a cut down roster, on December 11th, 1934, the National League votes to allow night baseball. The American League would not follow suit for another 3 years.
And the Cubs would not follow suit for another, what was it, five decades? Because that would have, the lights would obscure all of the neighborhood homes around Wrigley, and you couldn't have that. And finally, on December 15th, 1980, Dave Winfield becomes the highest paid player in sports history at that time when he agreed to a 10-year, $23 million contract with the Yankees. Of course, team owner George Steinbrenner believed that Winfield had actually agreed to $16 million, leading to a prominent public feud. Imagine that, Steinbrenner in a feud.
Oh, Yankees.
Very off-brand.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @jenmacramos. You can find Sarah at @sarahwexler32. You can find Mary at Miriam Craig. You can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.